Hello and welcome to the Guelph Politicast. I'm Adam A. Donaldson of Guelph Politico. Today I talk about Section 2B of Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms, or to put it another way, the freedom of expression or freedom of speech. In the last couple of weeks, we've seen a lot of discussion online about who was violating someone else's freedom of speech. But are we really aware of what that term entails? Do we know what it means when you use the term freedom of speech in Canada? You know what is the topic of this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The term freedom of speech seems so absolute, doesn't it? But would it surprise you to know that Canada's Charter of Rights and Freedoms doesn't actually use that term? In the Charter, freedom of expression, along with the freedom of thought, belief, and opinion, forms Section 2B under the fundamental freedoms of the Charter, and expression also includes freedom of the press and other media in communication. The other three fundamental freedoms are freedom of conscience and religion, freedom of peaceful assembly, and freedom of association. Perhaps already you see the cracks in the social media slap fight in the wake of the town hall held by the People's Party leader Maxime Bernier last week in Guelph. PPC members and supporters accused a group of stifling the free speech by planning a protest at the original venue, and then the protesters felt robbed of their chance to express themselves to Bernier when the venue was moved out of a fear of violence, though no specific threat of violence was ever made. Meanwhile, the PPC gave a condition to the media that they could cover the Bernier Town Hall, except that they couldn't publish the location before, during, or after the event. Was the press's own freedom of expression being infringed upon? This kind of situation seems like an ideal test case of sorts to ask some basic questions about what freedom of expression means and how free our speech really is, but I needed an expert. That led to James Turk. Turk is a distinguished visiting professor at Ryerson University and the director of Ryerson's Center for Free Expression. He's written extensively on academic freedom, university governance, civil liberties, the commercialization of universities, and related public policy issues, and his most recent book, an edited collection called Academic Freedom in Conflict, The Struggle Over Speech Rights in the University, was just released in 2014. So in this week's edition of the Guelph Politicast, James Turk gives us a primer on the freedom of expression in Canada, what your rights and responsibilities are when it comes to that freedom, and why the freedom of expression doesn't just mean the right to say whatever you want. We also talk about the effect of our bubbles on freedom of expression and how our social media silos might be having a negative effect on our ability to hear things we may disagree with. And we also talk about the issues of anonymity with social media, the paradox of people like Alex Jones, who uses his platforms to lie and harass, and whether we might all benefit from lessons about free expression in our civics classes. So I caught up with James Turk last week by phone. So, Jim Turk, thank you so much for joining me today.
My pleasure.
I wanted to start with, it may be a big question, but I felt it was like the most, like the simplest distillation of what I wanted to get at today. Do you or I or anyone in Canada have the right to say what we want, whenever we want, wherever we want?
More or less, we do.
Mm-hmm.
It is a big question. our Charter of Rights and Freedoms recognizes freedom of expression as one of the four fundamental freedoms. And as a result of that, our courts have been very reluctant to restrict expression except in very specific ways. So in general answer to your question, yes.
Mm-hmm.
There are some things we're not allowed to do. Expression that is violence or advocates violence,
mm-hmm.
Doesn't have the protection of the Charter.
Mm-hmm.
We do have restrictions on speech after the fact. If I say something or write something defamatory about you or someone else, you can sue me for defamation. There are those kinds of restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
Then outside of the public realm, in the workplace, in schools, there are various restrictions on expression.
Mm-hmm.
But in the public realm, and I assume you were talking about speaking publicly,
mm-hmm.
There are very few. We do have, in Section 300, in Section 319(1)(2) of the Criminal Code, we do have restrictions on hate speech, which a lot of people assume imposes a fairly broad restriction on what can be said.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably the best known restriction that people talk about, and one hears all the time references to, well, this person can't be allowed to speak at this venue or at the
right.
university or the library because they're going to be engaging in hate speech. But then again, probably 95% of what is called hate speech may be hateful speech, but it's not hate speech as restricted by our criminal code. So even there, it's only a very narrow range of truly horrible speech that's restricted under hate speech laws.
Mm-hmm. Because I feel like, and maybe you feel the same, maybe studying this a bit more broadly than I have, but it seems like, and maybe it's a social media phenomenon too, that if somebody is called out for something or they are barred from a platform like, say, Facebook and Twitter, the immediate reaction is you are violating this person's free speech. And it seems like we throw around that term without kind of fully understanding its exact definition and its various intricacies too, because I have a feeling it's not as simple as that.
Well, I mean, first of all, the Charter protects freedom of expression, and freedom of expression is two sides. It's both your ability to say what you want,
mm-hmm.
but also my ability to hear what I want.
Mm-hmm.
So that when if you restrict somebody from speaking, you're stopping my ability to hear them.
Right.
Right. So the Charter is a restriction. I mean, is a limit on what governments can do or the state can do
mm-hmm.
in restricting speech. In a private setting, if you're in my home or you're in my business, I can say you don't have a right to say that. You know.
Right.
So the rights to free expression are in public places and with respect to the freedom that from state restriction and supervision.
Mm-hmm. It also strikes me as there's kind of a responsibility to that too. And I think this is an angle that we don't really get to, that there's a sort of absolutism about being able to exercise free speech, but does the Charter say anything about, you know, sort of the responsibility of free speech?
Well, no, it does not.
Mm.
I can certainly understand the question.
Yeah.
It leads in a very difficult direction. So,
right.
the problem is everybody in the abstract is in favor of free speech
mm-hmm.
until they come across expression that they loathe mm-hmm. or find deeply offensive. And then suddenly free speech becomes a problem.
Mm-hmm.
And the difficulty is there's hardly any speech that some people don't find offensive.
Right.
So, for example, for pro-life groups, they find advocacy of abortion deeply offensive. They see mm-hmm. abortion as murder.
Right.
So somebody advocating abortion rights is engaging in the most horrible speech they see as equivalent of advocacy of violence, advocacy of murder, and feel it would be entirely appropriate to disallow that expression.
Mm-hmm.
Conversely, people who are in favor of a woman's right to choose find anti-abortionists deeply offensive.
Right.
And find the kind of language around stopping people's rights to abortion or making it illegal or putting abortion doctors in jail for life as horrible speech.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Now, the problem is, what's the responsibility of a pro-life person or of a pro-choice person? Well, they don't have a responsibility to avoid offending the other side. They have every right to express their views.
Right.
And if you start saying, well, you got to temper what you're going to say by being sensitive to how others might hear it, you go down a slope where almost anything that's charged or contentious could be restricted.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are, I mean, just to qualify that,
yeah.
when I'm teaching a course
mm-hmm.
at the university, or if I were a high school teacher or a grade school teacher, different rules apply.
Mm-hmm.
In the sense that my job as an educator, as a teacher, is to create an environment in which students can learn.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously, I have a responsibility to cover material or to respond to students in a way that helps them learn. So if a student, I'm teaching first year biology, and a student says, well, I know that evolution is a bunch of BS and that we were all created by God in 6 days and that in the last 6,000 years,
right.
I don't have a right to mock them or say, you stupid idiots or whatever.
Right.
I have to find a way of saying, well, interpreting what the science on that is. And so we do have responsibilities in a variety of contexts.
Mm-hmm.
An employer can't treat an employee dismissively or embarrassingly.
Right.
But in general, in advocacy, in a public debate about a position, I have a right, and it's important that we have a right to be passionate about it. So some climate scientists are absolutely outraged by the position that some politicians take in dismissing the importance of environmental matters.
Mm-hmm.
And so they may offend the politicians, they may offend their supporters in the vigor of their advocacy, and it really is a restriction on their free expression rights to say, well, wait a minute, you have a responsibility to be more toned down, to be less impassioned about this.
Mm-hmm. It's almost like it's implicit that if you are confronted with speech, like you mentioned climate change denial, for example, that if you're confronted by someone making false points, then the onus is on you to use your free speech to sort of correct them and use the facts and use your right to free expression as the counterweight to that.
That's right. I mean, the importance of freedom of expression.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll talk in a second about why it's important, but the importance of it is that the way you deal with expression you don't like is not through censorship.
Right.
Not through stopping that speech, but by counter speech.
Mm-hmm.
So that if someone is, I have little patience with anti-vaxxers, for example. I'd love it if they weren't heard. I think they do a huge amount of damage because people don't have the measles vaccine and so forth. But the way to deal with that is not to say, well, I want a law passed that they can all be jailed or that that's hate speech and they can be prosecuted. But rather, you respond to it critically. You point to what the evidence is. If they have events, you can go to the event and raise questions. You can protest outside it.
Mm.
Or you can decide, well, the best way to deal with speech you really hate, it may be tactically just to boycott it and ignore it and hope nobody pays much attention to it. I mean, we have a whole bunch of options.
Right.
But censorship or imposing state authority to stop it is not an option that one can use without fundamentally undermining our democracy. But also, it never works.
Right.
You don't stop offensive things by censorship. It just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm.
Europe, for example, most countries in Europe have far more extensive hate speech laws than Canada, and certainly more than the United States, which doesn't have hate speech laws.
Right.
There's not a shred of evidence that there's any less racism or anti-Semitism or Islamophobia in Europe as a result of their really, in some cases, draconian hate speech laws than there is in Canada or the United States.
Mm.
When you try to censor people, what you often do is drive the unwanted behavior underground. It often develops in a more virulent form and reappears.
Mm-hmm.
You sometimes make the people you're censoring seem to others as martyrs. It's not an effective way to counter that which you find deeply troubling.
Well, let me put it to you this way, because I think you talking about like sort of forcing people underground, you also mentioned anti-vaxxers too. And
right.
And it seems to me that when we're talking about the equal playing field, where we're, kind of both on the same plateau, we can have these more intellectual kind of debates. But in the modern context, we are seeing ourselves sort of siloed more. And if you are an anti-vaxxer and you don't want to hear the arguments of the pro-vax side, you can maintain your life in your bubble and just, you know, be on the pro or be on the anti-vax Facebook groups and the anti-vax social media pages and sort of be in your own group. And, you know, it's almost like we have created a world where we kind of avoid the debate now. Like, free expression has kind of been self-censored almost.
Well, what you're pointing to is absolutely true. Mm. And largely, at the extreme, it is because of social media.
Mm-hmm.
With the internet and with social media, we've moved from the days where there were a limited number of media that the rest of us had access to.
Mm-hmm.
So now everyone can be their own publisher.
Mm-hmm.
There's hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of sources of content that you can get through social media and through the internet. And people are able to create their own, some others refer to it as filter bubbles.
Mm-hmm.
So that if I'm a hard right conservative in the United States, I can listen to Fox News. I don't ever have to go out of my bubble.
Mm-hmm.
I can get all the news on anything I want and not be confronted with anything contrary to my perspective. Or if I'm a left winger, I can do the same.
Mm-hmm.
When I was a kid growing up in Canada, we had access to CBC and CTV. Everybody in the country had sort of the same sources of news. And in the United States, there was ABC and NBC, and there were broadcasters like Walter Cronkite or in Canada, Noel Nash,
mm-hmm.
who became sort of revered figures. And whether we agreed or disagreed, we were discussing the same issues. But now we can avoid all of that. We just don't have to hear anything we don't like. And then when we occasionally are confronted with something we don't like, our many people's first response is, I shouldn't have to hear that.
Right.
When Jordan Peterson comes on campus, there are all sorts of people who say, oh, my God, I can't. It's not safe to be here with him speaking. We have to have a safe space. The campus has to be safe
right.
from those kinds of views.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's a terrible way to... I couldn't disagree more with Jordan Peterson.
Right.
But the way to deal with that is either I just don't bother to go hear him.
Right.
Or if I'm exercising what he has to say, I write an article or I go to his talk and ask him difficult questions. That's how we learn in advance and inform ourselves.
Right.
I did want to say, if I may,
yeah.
I think what gets lost in this discussion frequently are the reasons why our charter identifies freedom of expression as one of the four fundamental freedoms,
mm-hmm.
and why freedom of expression is so important. And there's really three reasons. The first one is what's been called self-realization. It's how we become who we are.
Right.
We hear ideas growing up in our families. We then go to high school or go to a college or university. And when we express some of those ideas, people say they're stupid or what is this? Or we learn new things and we try it out. And people say, that's great. Or people say, that's not quite right. Yeah, look at this. And we evolve and change our views over our whole lifetime. And it's only because we have this freedom
mm-hmm.
to hear different perspectives. And we're often confronted. Experience of a lot of kids when they go to university is they're confronted with ideas that they never heard before or that are deeply antithetical to what they were taught as kids in their own homes.
Right.
And it's confronting those, thinking them through. Whatever position you come down on, it's your position.
Mm-hmm.
But it's informed by the ability to hear and consider and debate and discuss and try out ideas. So that's the first reason free expression is so important.
Right.
The second is for the advancement of knowledge.
Mm.
Most of the things we take for granted now were heretical or crazy or whatever at some point in the past.
Mm-hmm.
When Galileo thought that and made the argument that the earth revolves around the sun, it was so outrageous that he was threatened with torture it wasn't until the 1930s that the Catholic Church apologized for how he had been treated.
Yeah.
But in medicine, in physics, in sociology, there are any number of ideas that we now see as right, mm-hmm. that we're seeing as wrong. One of the famous cases was two gastroenterologists who thought that the idea that ulcers were caused by stress and so forth were just wrong.
Right.
They thought it was a bacteria. And they were almost laughed out of their jobs. And because there was humans, they couldn't do experiments to prove it.
Right.
And they almost got fired from their job. They were mocked as being crazy. One of them then took the bacteria, developed a very severe ulcer, and now we recognize that that is the cause of ulcers, and they've got the Nobel Prize. But, I mean, there's stories like that through almost any field. So it's really important to allow expression that you might not like or seems crazy or whatever, because it may turn out to be right, or it may lead to other ways of thinking. The last reason is perhaps the most important, that's for democracy. Mm-hmm. Democracy is not primarily about the rule of law. Mm-hmm. Democracy is about an unending public discussion about what's legitimate and what's not legitimate.
Right.
And if a majority at any one point in time can shut down that discussion, saying, well, we now know what's legitimate and we're not open to any challenges to that, we have the end of democracy.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, a fundamental underpinning of democracy is this right
mm-hmm.
to have all sorts of views expressed. And the price we pay for that is we often have to hear nasty, stupid, unwelcome ideas because we have no way of knowing in the end which ideas are going to prove to be more useful, because a lot of ideas that seem pretty stupid in the Middle Ages are not, you know, it wasn't that long ago that slavery was thought to be a great idea,
right?
So forth. Certainly, so it's for self-realization, it's for the advancement of knowledge, it's for the, you know, for democracy, that we have such a commitment to freedom of expression,
mm-hmm.
and why governments like the government of Canada
mm-hmm.
Are very reluctant to restrict people's freedom of expression and people's right ability to hear
mm-hmm.
Divergent viewpoints.
I this is one of those things where I'm listening to you and I'm like, I feel that's right, and then I'm also sitting here thinking about people who post something on Twitter that gets one group of people so riled up that they're doxxed, or the people who lost their children at the Sandy Hook Elementary School shooting, who Alex Jones said they were crisis actors with, you know, they didn't have kids, and these people are forced into hiding because people who follow Alex Jones start sending them death threats. And, you know, I think this is where the rubber meets the road, as it were.
Well, I mean, there's no question that people saying offensive things isn't new. One can mm-hmm. think back 1,000, 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
What is new is the ability to disseminate these terrible ideas.
Right.
I mean, social media allows this kind of stuff. So, you know, somebody like Alex Jones in the pre-social media era would have had none of us would have ever heard of him.
Right.
Right. I mean, there's always been crackpots who've issued statements, published their own little sheets. I mean, 40 years ago would have had a Gestetner machine and duplicated and handed out street corners, and maybe 100 people would have seen it.
Yeah.
But now they can, you know, if they have a computer, now it can be distributed all over the world in seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And how do we deal with that is a serious problem. But what we do know is trying to shut them down, somehow physically prevent them from distributing their ideas, A, isn't possible,
mm-hmm.
and B, doesn't stop the dissemination of bad ideas.
Mm-hmm.
So we as a society really do have to engage the question you're asking.
Mm-hmm.
We can't just disregard and say, well, we have free expression, and to hell with the consequences. And
right.
I mean, let me give you an example, a concrete example. I hear at Ryerson
mm-hmm.
Frequently, especially from students from marginalized groups, I shouldn't experience racism on campus.
Right.
And we're not talking just about, you know, the kind of hateful racism that we're hearing from the President of the United States at the moment or from neo-Nazi groups.
Sure.
But also, you know, all sorts of microaggressions. I mean, there are all sorts of experiences that marginalized people have that they find hateful. And they say, I shouldn't experience that on campus. And you, the administration, has to do something about it.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have a lot of people on the right respond by saying, oh, for God's sakes, get a life. This is the real world. You know, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names won't, words won't hurt you. What are you, snowflakes? And they have a variety of derisive terms. And that's how the debate gets posed.
Right.
And it's a horrible way for it to be posed because those students are absolutely right.
Mm-hmm.
They shouldn't be experienced to racist expression on campus.
Right.
Or racism. They shouldn't be experienced to racism on campus or in society.
Mm-hmm.
But where they're wrong is the solution isn't to stop racist speech.
Right.
I wish we could get rid of racism by stopping racist speech. We can't.
Right.
Racism is a far more complex, deeper problem. And if we're serious about it, instead of having debates about what kind of speech should be restricted and what kind of speech shouldn't, we have to be addressing the fundamental social and economic inequality in our society, our flawed criminal justice system. I mean, there's any number of things that have to be addressed. So in advocating free speech, it's not to deny the consequences of a lot of expression, but rather to say censorship isn't the way effective way to deal with it.
Right. It just seems like we're kind of, I guess the reaction is, and this is, I think, a problem with all sides of just about any argument, is that we're ill-prepared to sort of talk about things. We're prepared to defend our position. We're prepared to cut off other forms of thought, but we aren't prepared to sit there and listen. And it makes me wonder, you know, are we not sort of training ourselves and maybe young people who are coming up? Is this another example of where sort of civics classes in the 21st century are sort of failing us, where we have kids who aren't familiar with the political system, they aren't familiar with the political past, they aren't familiar with like some of these basic tenets of the charter, including free speech. And, you know, by the time they become adults and, you know, it's up to them to sort of find where they sit in all of this, they are sort of lost. And it just becomes a matter of, no, I'm going to build this wall against anything that conflicts with my way of thinking.
Well, I just have two quick comments on that.
Yeah.
I mean, first, you're absolutely right. I mean, I wish there were more history classes and civics classes and all that. On the other hand, we have the most educated population we've ever had in our history.
Mm-hmm.
Uneducated views are hardly new. It's true those who go to school aren't getting as much, but many more people are going to school and to university than ever before.
Right.
One of the things that diminishes our ability to express our views, to debate, is if we can avoid having to hear the contrary views, we don't develop the ability to refute them.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, one of the strengths of freedom of expression, I guess the way I'd approach would be, let's take with regard to racism.
Mm-hmm.
I have an obligation as part of my free speech. If I hear somebody saying something that I find deeply offensive or wrong or hurtful, it's to confront that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I can go through my life never having to hear that stuff, I don't develop my arguments, my analysis, who lets me be articulate in confronting that which I disagree with.
You don't know what you're defending.
Yes. You know, you have a gut feeling that this is the right thing, but in fact, it's by having to deal with these difficult issues that you both think through more clearly what your position is.
Mm-hmm.
You might modify it as a result,
mm-hmm.
but you also, for those who are listening to you, I'll give you one concrete example. After Charlottesville, remember in Virginia,
mm-hmm.
the awful white supremacist neo-Nazi march, a a group of white supremacists in Boston wanted to have a what they call it a free speech mm-hmm. rally.
Right, right, right.
And there was enormous pressure on the city of Boston and the state of Massachusetts to disallow it, to prevent it, because it was, you know, in the light of what just had happened in Charlottesville, how can we allow this to go forward?
Right.
In the United States, they have the First Amendment, where it'd be very hard for a city or a state to disallow that in the absence of any evidence that illegal behavior was going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And so it went ahead. Those who were opposed to it had to figure out, well, what are we going to do in light of this? And so they organized a social justice rally to compete with it.
Right.
And so what the world saw was 30 or 40 angry, actually viciously angry, mostly older white men frothing mm-hmm. at the mouth in some basement.
Mm-hmm.
And at the same time, a rally of 10 to 20,000 people for social justice.
Right.
Now, I happen to think we're all better off that it happened that way.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas had we disallowed the white supremacists from speaking, first of all, people wouldn't have seen them and seen them for what they were.
Right.
Secondly, some people who hadn't thought about this a lot would say, oh, gosh, that's really unfair that they were shut down. I mean, they might be seen partially as martyrs, or that the words they were going to express were so powerful that the state had to stop them from speaking, when they're a bunch of jerks saying horrible, hateful things. And I think it's better for the world to see that and see a counterpoint to it, which the social justice rally was, than to have it suppressed.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me wrap up by posing this specific example. One of the reasons I wanted to talk to you was we were supposed to have this Q&A town hall with Maxime Bernier here in Guelph.
Yes.
This Friday over the weekend. They didn't cancel the event. They just canceled having the public event. They're going to have it, like a secret event or like sort of an invite-only event. But it was in response to the People's Party EDA here were afraid that there might be some violence from people who are going to protest the site of the event, people who identified as sort of members of the local Communist Party, also people who identify as anti-fascist. So I have a feeling that both sides are sort of, you know, coming back to, I think, what this interview has been about, that, you know, we have two sides with very disparate point of views who have now seemed to go out of the way to avoid talking to each other. So I do want to know what your opinion is on this.
Okay, well, I mean, in fact, with regard to Maxime Bernier or Canadian politics, we don't have two sides. We have many sides.
Right.
Right. And so Bernier would be on the farther right end of the conservative spectrum.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a whole lot of people from there to sort of middle of the road to a moderately liberal to a left wing to a Marxist perspective.
Yeah.
Canadians are scattered along that continuum. So there's a couple of things in your example.
Mm-hmm.
The first is, was there a genuine threat of violence? If there was, the police have an obligation to ensure
right.
that legitimate activity, legitimate political activity is not stopped by violence. Violence is illegal, full stop.
Right.
So there's that concern. It can be held in a different venue. There's a variety of ways that can be dealt with. For people who are opposed to Bernier, I certainly would be one. I probably wouldn't go hear him.
Right.
But if I wanted to expose what I thought was wrong with his views, I would go and try to ask difficult questions.
Mm-hmm.
Or I would take a picket sign and a leaflet and join others in picketing outside his event saying, here's what this guy is, here's what he stands for, here's what's wrong with him, blah, 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 to get a counterpoint.
Mm-hmm.
We're better off as a society if we deal with that, if there is an actual debate.
Right.
Or at least different perspectives expressed so other people can make up their own minds.
Mm-hmm.
Because Maxime Bernier and his party are going to be there and they're going to be trying to get voters. And if they get suppressed, it's going to make them more attractive to certain people.
Mm.
And the rest of us don't get to hear, you know, it may be the media misrepresents what he has to say. He may be worse, or he may be not as bad, or maybe more nuanced or less nuanced. I mean, who knows?
Right.
But in a democratic society, all of us have, if we want, have a right to hear what he has to say and to evaluate it ourselves. And those of us don't like him or his views have a right to have our criticism of those heard. So again, people can be more informed. So it's really sad that what happened has happened. Because now, you know, as you've described it, he'll be speaking to a small group of supporters who he doesn't need to speak to. They're already on his side.
Right.
And he's denied the opportunity, and all the rest of us are denied opportunity for the kind of discussion and debate that would help inform our own views, especially going into an election in October.
So, James Turk, thank you so much for all your insights today, and we'll keep on trying to make sure we all get to express ourselves freely, as it were.
Well, I'm grateful for you and your podcast. I mean, this is part of how the public gets informed, by listening to podcasts from different perspectives and going in depth into different issues.
It's nice.
So thank you for...
It's nice when we end on agreement, so thank you.
Okay, take care.
And once again, that was James Turk, and you can learn more about Turk and his work at Ryerson Center for Free Expression by visiting their website at cfe.ryerson.ca. And did you know that the Government of Canada will send you your own personal copy of the Charter in either a poster or certificate size for free? You can order your copy by visiting the Heritage Canada section of the Government of Canada website, and I will include the precise link in the show notes. And that's it for this edition of the Guelph Politicast. The music for the Guelph Politicast comes from KPM Classics and Sid Dale. You can download the Guelph Politicast on Wednesday from the podcast apps iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and Spotify. You can also download it from the host at Podbean at guelphpoliticast.podbean.com. And when you subscribe to the Guelph Politicast channel, you will also get an episode of Open Sources Guelph on Mondays and an episode of End Credits on Fridays. You can get in touch with me by email at adamadonaldson@gmail.com. Reach me through Twitter at adamadonaldson. You can check out Guelph Politico on Facebook at facebook.com/politicoguelph. And if you'd like to help build a locally sourced independent media outlet in the city of Guelph, then please consider donating to Guelph Politico, and you can find out how at guelphpolitico.ca/donate. And for all the latest local political news, check out guelphpolitico.ca, where there will be a new episode of the Guelph Politicast for you very shortly. And until then, we'll see you next time.